You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Tonight, we're delighted to be presenting three authors we deeply admire. So thanks for being here. Reina Grande is an award-winning author, educator, and longtime Californian. Her new memoir, A Dream Called Home, charts the aftermath of her own border crossing, a story beautifully told in her National Book Critics Circle Award-nominated memoir, The Distance Between Us, which is now assigned reading in schools across the country. Her new work, which we'll hear a bit of in a moment, possibly, follows the journey of that 9-year-old girl who came to America as she becomes the first member of her family to graduate from college in pursuit of her own American dream. In the words of Viet Thanh Nguyen, writers in need of inspiration should read this book. Reina last joined us in 2015 for a bilingual conversation with Sandra Cisneros, a meaningful night for me and many. It was one of the first Aloud programs I had the privilege of supporting. Born in San Diego and a graduate of USC, Jean Guerrero is an Emmy-winning journalist who has reported widely on cross-border issues for NPR and the Wall Street Journal. Winner of the Penn Fusion Emerging Writers Prize, Jean will read from her fascinating memoir, Crux, in which she turns her investigative eye on the enigma of her family history, a mystical history, and her elusive father, a brilliant Mexican immigrant struggling with depression, substance abuse, and the belief he is a target of the CIA. And joining us from outside Ashland, Oregon, is Octavio Solis, one of the most prominent Latin playwrights in America, whose works have been produced next door at the Mark Taper Forum, as well as Yale Rep, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, California Shakespeare, and venues across the country. He's been an NEA Fellow. He has received the Kennedy Center's Roger L. Stevens Award, the National Latino Playwriting Award, and the Penn Award for Drama, and is recently the recipient of the 2019 Distinguished Achievement in the American Theater Award. Retablos is his first book, which he will read from tonight, which conjures the El Paso borders of his youth. Jean, Octavio, and Reina will be signing books in the lobby, where books are also for sale, courtesy of the library store. And so you can speak to them afterwards in the lobby, as well as one of us, staff of the Library Foundation, if you're interested in becoming a member and you are not one already. Thank you for being here, and please join me in welcoming Jean, Reina, Octavio.
Buenas noches. Gracias por estar aquí. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here today. We would like to start by dedicating tonight's program to the former directors of Aloud, Louise Steinman and Maureen Moore. They are the reason why the three of us are here today. And we wanted to show our gratitude and appreciation to them, and that we wish they were here with us tonight as well, but they're in our hearts and in our minds tonight. Thank you. So I have been reading from A Dream Called Home for about a month and a half since the book came out. And if you haven't had a chance to read the book yet, I write about my search for a home and my dream of being a professional writer. And I also write about my experiences as a brand new mother and how motherhood allowed me to have a better and deeper relationship with my parents. So I write about when I had my son. The problem is that now I also have a daughter, and they fight like cats and dogs. And they have been fighting a lot over this book because he's in the book and she's not. So because of that, I decided to write a story that features my daughter. And it made her happy, but she made me promise I would write a whole book about her too. So I'm going to have to work on that. So tonight I'm gonna read from that story about my daughter, because I have been reading a lot about my son and how having my son helped me to understand the sacrifices that my father had made in leaving me and my brother and sister behind in Mexico to come here to try to find a better life for us. And I had always thought of my parents from the point of view of the daughter that they left behind. But it was when I had my son that I started to realize that because of that decision that my father had made to leave his children and try to find something better for them, now I was going to be able to be the parent that my father couldn't be for me. I would get to stay now with my children and watch them grow up. So these are some of the things that I learned when I became a mother. So in this story that I'm going to read to you tonight, I explore how my immigrant experiences have now impacted my relationship with my children, which is a different perspective. And this is called A Migrant Story, and it just got released today in this beautiful anthology called Love Can Be, a literary collection about our animals. And I get to be in this really beautiful book with authors like Ursula Le Guin, which is awesome, Essie Hinton, and Joyce Carol Oates. I'm still pinching myself. All right, so A Migrant Story. Every year, millions of monarch butterflies migrate from Canada to Mexico, where they spend their winters. They face many perils along their nearly 3,000-mile journey. Unpredictable weather, pesticides, low supply of milkweed, loss of habitat. Despite the traumatic experiences before, during, and after the journey, the monarch knows that its migration is the only way to ensure the survival of the next generation and the next. As a former undocumented immigrant, I have long admired the monarch butterfly's will to live. For the monarch and for me, and for the millions of people in the world forced to leave their homelands, migration is an act of survival. The monarch butterfly has become a powerful symbol for the undocumented immigrant community. It serves as a reminder that every living thing on earth deserves to thrive in peace and harmony, that for both insect and human, migration is not a crime, but a necessity. In my garden in Los Angeles, I planted milkweed and other flowering plants to provide a safe haven for the local monarch population and do my part to protect this magnificent creature. I shared my love of gardening with my daughter, Eva, who was 7 years old at the time of this story. And while we weeded or planted bulbs, I would talk to her about the plight of the monarch population. I told her that 20 years ago, over 1 billion monarchs would make the journey south. Now their numbers are at the lowest they've ever been. As with all migrants, their struggle to survive is harder today than ever before. We humans are plowing away more and more land and leaving no room for milkweed or nectar plants, spraying harmful pesticides on our farmlands and cutting down the forests where the monarchs spend their winters. Something needs to be done, I told my daughter. Eva said that she would grow up to be an entomologist. I'll save the monarchs, she declared. She squealed in delight every time a butterfly visited our garden. I explained to her that they were laying eggs in the milkweed we had planted for them. When we watched the documentary about butterflies, Eva could no longer wait until she grew up to save them. She had to start that very day with our local population. She wanted to carry out a rescue mission to save the monarchs from the only threat she could see in our pesticide-free garden, predators. Eva and I began to gather the milkweed leaves that had tiny eggs attached to their underside and put them in containers, safe from the spiders and praying mantises that lived in the garden. Once the caterpillars were grown, we transferred them to a butterfly habitat where they pupated before our eyes. Those 3 minutes of watching a yellow, black, and white striped caterpillar transform into a brilliant emerald green chrysalis were magical. We gasped at seeing the tiny gold spots and a golden ring shimmering around the chrysalis. Eva kept a journal where she wrote down every detail, and she learned to predict when the butterflies would be born. During the next 10 days, we watched in awe as the chrysalis became transparent until we could see the black and orange butterfly nestled within. We released the new butterflies in the garden the same day they were born. To Eva, every butterfly was a girl, and she always gave them names. We would wave goodbye and wish them a safe journey. "Bye, Pearl. Bye, Sunshine," she would say. "Come visit soon." Standing beside my daughter, I felt connected to her through this shared experience. We had been part of the cycle of life of this precious insect and bore witness to its metamorphosis. One September day, one of the caterpillars did not attach itself securely enough to the roof of the butterfly habitat. In the middle of pupation, the chrysalis fell to the floor, and when we found it, one side was flat. My daughter and I used tape to hang the cocoon as carefully as we could, but when the monarch emerged from its chrysalis, its right wing was shorter than its left. "I'm afraid we can't release it," I told my daughter. "She won't be able to fly." A healthy monarch had a difficult road ahead in her fight for life. A monarch who couldn't fly was doomed. "I will teach Buttercup to fly," Eva said. I didn't have the heart to tell my daughter that it was not possible. How could a human teach a butterfly to fly, especially one with a severe disability? Every day, Eva would take Buttercup out to the garden and place her on the butterfly bush to drink nectar and enjoy the sunlight. She would sit Buttercup on her index finger and raise her hand up and down to get wind under Butterfly's wings. Buttercup would take off into the air only to fall seconds later. Eva would pick her up from the grass and try again. For several days, Eva put on fresh orange slices for Buttercup, and when the sun had warmed the garden, she would take her out to eat nectar and practice flying. I watched from the window, wondering how to prepare my daughter for the inevitable. Buttercup would spend the rest of her too short life with us. She was never going to fly. This butterfly, like me, had been born to struggle, something that my children knew nothing about. I had been born with a great disadvantage too, an undocumented child immigrant from Iguala, Mexico, in the state of Guerrero, where 70% of the population lives in poverty. No one thought I could escape the circumstances I had been born into, but I had. Just like the monarch leaves her home to give her offspring a chance, I had left the country of my birth, risked my life to cross the border, and made the impossible possible. I transformed myself from being an undocumented immigrant to a successful published author. Because of my own migration to seek a better life in the U.S., I spared my children the trauma of being born in a shack made of sticks and cardboard, living without running water, walking around barefoot for lack of shoes, being hungry in every way. I spared my children the trauma of running across the border, the paralyzing fear of being caught and sent back, or worse, of perishing in the act of crossing. My children will never know what it's like to be labeled a criminal for simply wanting a better future, a chance to dream. They will never know the stigma of growing up undocumented, the trauma of trying to hold on to your roots while trying to assimilate into a new culture. They won't know the searing pain of a heart as it cleaves in two, fighting to maintain its Mexican identity while transforming into an American. Like my story, the monarchs is one of struggle and survival. As I watch my daughter share the fight with Buttercup and learn of perseverance and faith, I hope that her love for this butterfly would be the magic formula that would help Buttercup fly. A few days later, from the living room window, I watch my daughter do her usual routine. When she placed Buttercup on her finger and raised her hand up and down, Buttercup took off and soared off into the sky. I was expecting her to fall back down, but this time she didn't. She flew across the garden and over the neighbor's fence. I rushed outside and watched as Buttercup disappeared from sight. Eva's face was full of triumph and pride. She did it, Mommy. She flew. She did, I said. She really did. I don't know where Buttercup ended up. My daughter believes that her butterfly defied fate and went on to have a fulfilling life. I was happy to know that at least for this one moment, my daughter might have had a glimpse into my life. She witnessed firsthand what it's like to rise above the circumstances one is born into and find the strength to survive. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for coming. It's great to be here alongside such incredible authors. So this is my debut book, Crux. It's about my quest to understand my father, who is a Mexican immigrant who my mother always told me had paranoid schizophrenia. And I became obsessed with trying to figure out what was really going on with him, because as I got to know him better as a journalist, this explanation didn't satisfy me. But in my obsession with him, I began to sort of reenact a lot of his self-destructive behaviors and to spiral down a very dark path. And so this book was really my attempt to disentangle myself ultimately from my father. And this section is from the prologue. I'm sorry, papi. Perdóname. I know how much you hate to be pursued. You've spent your whole life running. Now the footsteps chasing you are mine. Papi, ¿dónde estás? I lost myself searching for you. Trees sprout from the vaulted ceiling. The sky stretches far beyond my feet. The wind sounds human when it whispers. The roads are cobblestone, conch, and caracol. Everything is shape-shifting. You say spies or spirits pursue you. My mother, a physician, blames schizophrenia. I'm a journalist. I value the objective, the verifiable. In college, I minored in neuroscience. I studied the labyrinthine patterns of brain cortices, the chemical bases of hallucinations and delusions of persecution. But I am also your daughter, papi. In Mexico, I discovered a mundo mágico of corpses, chupacabras, curanderos. I learned that your great-grandmother was a clarividente. They called her la divina, the diviner. She was paid to commune with the dead. Papi, ¿quién eres? A cursed curandero? A schizophrenic? A victim of the mind control experiments you describe? I look into the mirror seeking clues. Your quests and questions consumed me, even though you were never there. The last time I saw you was the year the world was meant to end. When I close my eyes, papi, all the clocks rewind to then. I'm going to skip ahead to a section. So my dad, he was a stay-at-home dad during my first years alive, and my mom, as a doctor, was very busy with patients. So I spent most of my time with him, and I think this connection that I established with him in my earliest memories is what really made the shift in his personality strike me and be traumatic for me. With his camcorder, Papi blended images of my face with flowers and of my mother's face with the sea. My father's filming was unusually expressive, featuring sunsets, cloud formations, bird flights. I study his attentive eye for the poetry of light and contours, his descriptive curiosity at its crux. What happened to this person? I dip my hands into the dark sea of the past, and all I grasp are questions. So another thing that happened when my dad began to slowly recede, because initially it manifested not as hallucinations, but as a depression and just no longer wanting to get out of bed. And he was the primary caretaker of all of the animals that we had acquired. So we had roosters, hamsters, rabbits, ducks, all kinds of animals. And when he began to be depressed, all of our animals began to die. I remember as a child, my awareness of death arose in parallel with my father's deterioration. And so I think that that is another reason that I became obsessed with trying to understand what was going on with my father. And here's a section from when that was happening. Once Papi's jardín was ready, he had created this elaborate garden. He retreated under his comforter. He did not let me or my sister join him for naps or cuddles. Something was dying inside of him, or perhaps had died upon his departure from the butcher block. Nature echoed him as if in sympathy. Flies reproduced in his compost pile and populated our house. With a swatter, I flattened their bodies, plucked off their wings, and made piles of them. His garden began to deteriorate. His fruit shriveled into wrinkled black sacks. Flowers drooped on their stalks. Even the cacti turned a sickly brown. The worms came out to feast. The rare time Papi emerged from his bedroom, he sat on our living room leather couch, burping, staring at the turned-off television. My sister and I picked the lint out of his belly button and the cheese out of his toenails. He smelled of cigarette smoke and sweaty armpits. I examined his hand's pinky nails, an inch longer than the rest. "Why are your pinky nails so long?" I asked. He thought for a few seconds. "To more easily pick the boogers out of my nose," he said, Big Bad Wolf style, then unleashed his cartoon chuckle. We cackled. It was contagious. It was years before I discovered that addicts use pinky nails as organic cocaine scoops. So my father had eventually began to use crack cocaine and travel across the world trying to escape what he thought were CIA operatives following him. And in the book, I felt, once I realized that this was a book I was going to write, I felt this obligation to give his subjective experience, to honor his subjective experience by including portions of it in the book. You felt a constant electric current through your body, a cold, hard, painful feeling, like particles of ice in your veins. If you touched anything metal, you felt immediate relief, as if the current was dissipating. This gave you an idea. You drove to my mother's house with a magnet and a piece of copper wire. You wanted to prove to Jeanette, my mother, scientifically, that something was happening to you. You held up the copper and the magnet tied to a string. The copper caused the magnet to move wildly on its string, a physical impossibility unless the copper had a strong electric current running through it. Here was evidence that you were charging the copper as you held it. Mom saw this, I ask you years later. Yes, you say emphatically. But I guess she's not analytical. When I ask my mother about the demonstration, she says she has no memory of it. I don't know, maybe I ignored him. It's not like you can take somebody like that seriously. So you're saying it may have happened? She shrugs. When you don't believe something, it doesn't matter if someone tries to prove it to you. You don't believe it. But knowing he was using hallucinogenic drugs, how could you believe him? Your father was very smart, but unfortunately, he messed up his brain really bad with drugs. What he thinks is real is not real. What he thinks happened did not happen. Downtown, among other crack addicts, you were believed. Surrounded by homeless people, you leaned your head back and placed a penny between your eyebrows. It instantly jumped off of you, as if zapped by your corporeal current. The witnesses backed away in fear and amazement. So I really wanted to explore this idea of my father as the ultimate migrant, crossing borders between countries, between madness and sanity, between substance abuse and sobriety, between science and spirituality, because he really did embody these dichotomies. He was this very brilliant person, very well-read, but also had this element to him that was very detached from reality. And ultimately, my search, this is the last section I'll read for you, led me to Mexico to try to figure out where he came from and how that had affected him. I moved to Mexico City on September 30th, 2010. My father's country had never been bloodier. Drug cartels were diversifying their portfolios with human trafficking, murder for hire, and kidnappings for ransom. My job was to report out of coffee plantations and cocoa farms, where corpses accumulated in clandestine graves. Abuela Carolina touched her fingers to my forehead, chest, and shoulders in the sign of the cross. My mother wept. Mexico had terrified me as a child. Now it loomed magnetic on the southern horizon. From the back of the Aeroméxico plain, I saw the capital. The protruding peaks of Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl were the eyes of the terrain. The city, like all cities in Spanish, struck me as feminine, la ciudad. It was evident in the curve of her back, in her maternal embrace of the dead. Every year, she sank a few more inches into the buried swamp of the ancient Tenochtitlan. Buildings of all shapes and colors rose from her skin. The unapologetic chaos of the landscape was congruous with the man she had conceived, the man awaiting me, the man I had come here to understand. I was plummeting into an alternate universe, into the dream of the city itself, where the laws of fairy tale physics reigned. Papi had long showed me how to palpate borders for a beyond. I'd found it everywhere. The United States had its own brand of fantasy, with its UFO sightings, mind control programs, and drug-infused raves. But the magic of Mexico was different. It was earthier, more organic, as elemental as nature, and as merciless. It recalled an old garden a young father built, a jardín that swallowed life and made it nil. The sight was exhilarating. It felt like coming home. Thank you.
It's an honor to be here at the Aloud series. And in addition to thanking Ms. Steinman and Ms. Moore, I also would like to extend our my thanks to Jen Dees, Libby McCarthy, and Jorge Martinez for seeing us through this. Like the memoirs we've been hearing, my book also sort of takes a kind of memory sort of track, but it feels more like flash fiction, and that's why I felt I had to write them down, because they seemed so dreamlike, especially at my age. Writing about my childhood seems so distant and dreamlike, and evanescent and brief, so I felt like these had to be brief as well. So I'm going to read a few of these. And yeah, they're about like growing up in El Paso. This one's called Wild Kingdom. He fired his gun at us, but not because he wants us dead. How could he? He's our dad. The same dad who took us to Rio Doso every summer for some fresh mountain air and got us new bikes for Christmas. The same dad who loves the Flip Wilson show and croons along to Lucha Villa on the radio. But something's collapsing inside him for sure. And lately, he's a tense, brooding man walking around the house with his hands clenched around some invisible, giant rubber band. He's still our dad, though. Our papa. We're supposed to be quiet in the afternoons because he's working six nights a week at this local greasy burger joint and he needs to sleep days. He's not so good when he's roused. He bellows for us to shut the hell up if we even pad down the halls too loud. And once he threw his shoe at my little brother and caught him right at the temple and almost knocked him out. So today, we figure we'll watch some TV with the volume low. We're all sitting around watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. But my mom's not happy about something. She's all knotted up and tight-lipped, chewing on a fingernail while the jackals nip at the wildebeest carcass. She suddenly charges into the room where he's sprawled on the bed and snarls something nasty about him coming home later than he's supposed to and smelling of drink on top of it. And he mutters something back, which results in Amma slamming the door and marching to the kitchen where she proceeds to wash the dishes as noisily as possible. He calls for her again after a while, and she stomps back to him. We hear them yelling in the room. My brothers and me ignore the episode as best as we can, but we're quietly wishing we were out with our sister at Escarate Park riding the cheap roller coasters. It looks like it's going to be another bad night. Then, the rubber band snaps, and Amma sprints right through the house yelling for us to run, ¡Córrele! ¡Tiene la pistola! With hardly a second to think about it, we're all scrambling to our feet and dashing after her as we hear pop, pop, pop. I'm the last one out, and just as I reach the door, I catch sight of a man I've never seen before. In t-shirts and boxers, hair mussed up, glowering like a lucha libre wrestler, and in his hand, one of the guns that he keeps hidden in his closet. As he fires off one more pop, I fling myself out the front door, swearing there's a bullet searing into the small of my back. But it's only fear burning there. Fear and exhilaration that we're out of the house unharmed. I think my mom's almost laughing. She's so scared. In stupefaction, Diana and Joe from next door come out to find us crouched behind their station wagon. The other neighbors from across the street have also decided this escapade is better than Wild Kingdom. A few minutes later, the Chota pull up with no less than 5 cruisers with 5 cops looking at the front door of our chante with their 5 thumbs on the butts of their big, black, shiny pistols. One officer comes over to get the story from my mom. He has a mustache like my dad's. The door of my house opens up a crack, and I hear this stranger croak out, "It's over. I put the gun away. You can come back now." Whose voice is that? So broken, so clogged with misery and fatigue. I'm wondering if this is where the police blow him away. This is how these barrio standoffs usually end. The officer with the mustache wants to know if he means to fire his weapon again. My mother shakes her head, but she can't chew the doubt off her fingernails. He can see it too, so he turns to me with a questioning look that shames me to the core. I want to explain to him the deal. I want to jump ahead 20 years for the words to say, maybe it's because he hasn't slept so good in months. Or maybe this job serving drunks and whores greasy food all night long doesn't pay for shit. Or maybe he's realized at last that he's had 5 kids in 5 years by the time he's 23 with a woman who deserves better than she's getting, and all the manhood dreams he conceived for his life are over for fucking ever. Because he's caught in a country that won't cut him a break except maybe to clean the toilets for the next shift, and no last-ditch scramble back across the border is going to raise his prospects in any way. Too late for that. So what if he has a few on the way home? So what if he's tired and surly these days? And so what if he took his gun out of his closet and shot off a couple rounds? He wasn't aiming for us. No way, you say. All the bullet holes are drilled into the floor like he meant to miss. Like he was only killing off our shadows. Maybe it's his own damn shadow he was really shooting at. Maybe the real crime happened a long time before this, and maybe another one's going to happen as soon as 5 thumbs get the notion. I know these out-of-range words are waiting for me and my father sometime in that more clear-headed day to come. But the present 12-year-old little shit just stands there whimpering like a fool who wants his dad back. The officer nods and walks calmly to the front screen door of my house, and they talk for a while, mustache to mustache. Then he turns to his fellow officers and gestures that it's okay and waves Amma over. Timidly to the door she goes, and the 3 of them cluster in private conference until she steps inside. Then the officer walks away, and just like that, the cruisers cruise away. The neighbors return to their homes, My brothers go back in the house for whatever comes after Wild Kingdom, and the tired old sun slumps behind the Franklin Mountains. I'm still standing by the station wagon, wondering what happened to my shadow. That's one. And this is one, it's about my little brother. He died of pneumonia and malnutrition. He was a year younger than I was, and he died when he was an infant. His name was Ernesto, and this piece is called Neto. I have a brother who died before he reached his first birthday. I think I ran into him at the airport. I'm waiting this one afternoon for a flight at El Paso International that keeps getting delayed every hour. I sit and put on my earbuds and listen to a random selection of electronica, jazz, maybe something ambient. There's a point where the sounds in your head synchronize with eye focus and everything drops into a general blur. I zone out like that for a minute, and gradually I sense him sitting across from me. My brother. I know it's him because he looks like me, only a year younger, less gray in his hair, fewer wrinkles around the mouth, sleepy, self-assured eyes, a face that don't give a shit. I never really liked the phrase comfortable in his skin because I've never been comfortable in mine. But he is. The way he sits, the way his work boots sprawl toward me, I have my sunglasses on, which is how I size him up without him knowing. I notice a silver cross around his neck, the kind that is both tribal and religious. There are four or five tiny black tats on his hands, and though I can't see it under his clothes, I suspect he wears the Guadalupe Virgin over his heart. I can tell by the gentle curl of his lips that they're more accustomed to speaking Spanish than English. He has his own inaudible music playing in his head, and judging by the cadence in his nod, I guess it's the boleros of my mom's old records. He is all the Mexican I have tried to be, but can't. Then, in that languorous haze, I see into his heavy-lidded eyes, and his essential nature lays itself bare. I'm a Sunday man, he says inside. I kneel when the father says to. I love my women. I sin against them and never apologize for it, except by loving them more. I know all the ways of loneliness and all the ways to nurse it. I'm a night bird, my eyes attuned to the nuances of dark. And it's in that place I hide my saddest dreams, my delirious vices. Pain is grace. I don't know how not to do something, only that not doing it brings more regret than I can bear. Trouble's bitten me so many times, it's left black marks on my hands, marks that commemorate loss and love and maybe an unborn child or two. I've seen death more than most, so count on me to be present at your last rites. That's how our blood must have it. I am lived in, a lived in man, your carnal, your bro. He cuts me a single glance that lasts as long as it takes to say his name, and his look says, because I'm dead, I got permission to fuck my life up and still outlive you. A woman's voice says something over the intercom, and he gets up and walks to his gate, and I get up and walk to mine. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was amazing. We're gonna open it up to questions in a little bit, in a few minutes, but we're gonna kind of take turns asking each other questions.
Yeah. I was really curious when I was reading your book, Octavio, how being a playwright either helped you to write your book or hindered you?
Well, I found it very liberating because for once I could write about things that didn't involve dialogue. Wasn't about two people talking to each other. I could describe scenery. I could describe the world. I could describe what's going on inside a person. And I found that very liberating. But I still needed a way in. And the way in was to write it in that kind of first-person voice. Mm-hmm. It's not third-person. It's first-person. It's written from the voice of this character who is, I guess, me. But sometimes it could take on the voice of someone else, like Neto or something. Excuse me, I don't mean to turn my back to you guys. So that made it a lot easier to imagine another character sort of speaking. I thought of them as kind of like extended monologues. Mm-hmm. So that was liberating for me.
Yeah, well, and that was the question that really came up for me, because as I was reading your work, I noticed that there wasn't a lot of dialogue. And I was like, wait, he's a playwright. Where's the dialogue? And you were very selective with it. But when you had the dialogue, like, it really threw a punch. So that really made me think about, you know, what you brought to this. And I did see, like, how beautiful your descriptions were. And I really loved also the very careful attention that you put into opening and closing. Like, you were very careful with how you open and how you immerse us in the story and then how you closed it.
Yeah, you know, that was a bit of a problem. I had to work through some of those stories because they all kind of wanted to end with a mic drop, you know, the guy, boom. and I went, oh, and my editor worked on me with that. She said, they all kind of, you tie them up really neatly at the end. Is there a way to kind of open it up a little bit? And, but that's because of my, the nature of me being a novice at writing prose. It's new. And so it's a thing I had to learn. That's true. I craft them like plays, like with a strong beginning to kind of immerse people in it immediately, and then something to kind of just tie up all the loose ends. Mm-hmm. And what I'm learning and what's wonderful about fiction is that it's good to have loose ends. The loose ends are tied up by you guys. Uh-huh. You tie the loose ends.
That's right.
That was a discovery.
Yeah, I just love what you did with that monologue. That was amazing. And Reina, one of the things that I loved the most about your book was how you chart your coming of age as a writer and all of the incredible challenges that you had to overcome. You depict these really heartbreaking scenes where you have interactions with teachers who don't seem to believe that your experiences, your life experiences, are even real. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process of documenting these challenges that you overcame and why you felt it was important?
Yeah, well, I had some traumatic experiences at school, so I get to write about my bad teachers, but I also write about my good teachers, the ones that made a huge difference in my life. And definitely when I was at the university, and the book starts when I arrived at UC Santa Cruz as the first in my family to set foot in a university. And I had a lot of challenges there because I was usually the only Latina in my classes in creative writing. And my teachers, whenever they would read my stories, which were about poverty, about broken homes, absent parents, border crossings, they would say, Reina, you have such a wild imagination. And I was constantly having to convince them that I was writing about my truth and my reality. So it was challenging, but those experiences actually helped me out a lot later on in my career as a writer because I learned how to stand up for my stories. I learned how to put on armor every time I went in to fight for the stories I was writing. And that taught me once I graduated and I started to pursue this writing career, because I got a ton of rejections, a ton, and I would remind myself that I knew how to fight, and I knew how to hold on fast to the vision of the stories that I wanted to tell. So to me, even though it was really difficult while I was going through it, I learned how to turn that negative experience into something positive that actually has helped me in my writing career through the years.
Right. And speaking about loose ends with Octavio, you do this really amazing job of conveying the people in your life as completely three-dimensional characters that you don't necessarily draw firm conclusions about, like the realizations that you came to about your father, how despite the fact that your parents had hurt you so much by abandoning you, they had also, through that process of migrating, made you the parent who could stay, which you talked about earlier. Can you talk a little bit about that, just that sort of ambiguity and exploring that?
Yeah, well, I think writing about my parents has really helped me to have a more, a deeper understanding about who they are as parents, the choices that they made, and how those choices impacted the family in very negative ways, where we're still dealing with that trauma of everything that we went through. But I've also learned to see the positive things that came out of those experiences. So up until I became a mother, I was I used to be very hurt about the fact that both of my parents had walked away from me to come here. And they left me behind in Mexico for many years until eventually my father went back and brought me across the border. But when I came, I felt a lot of hurt. I felt a lot of resentment and anger, and I had so many emotions that I was trying to figure out what to do with, that the only way that I was able to deal with those emotions was when I started to write about them. And that's what I write so much about, from the point of view of the child that was left behind. But then when I became a parent, I started to see things from a different perspective, in that I began to understand how those choices, even though they had hurt me so much, those choices that my parents made were going to allow me to be a completely different parent that they were. And I was going to be able to now watch my children grow up, spend their birthdays with them, spend holidays with them. I was never going to be a stranger to my children the way my father was a stranger to me. So I've learned to see the positive from that experience. And in seeing the positive has helped me to also heal the little girl that was still hurting from being left behind.
Yeah. And I would also add that even in the writing, in your book, you did not adopt the same habits as your parents, because you went, when you felt your own sister was abandoned in Mexico, you went. You applied for a grant and got money and used it on the pretext that she was going to do research on her town. You flew there to rescue her, to find her and rescue her. So you were already living, making very different choices than your parents had. So there's growth within you, even as you're writing, even in the writing. But it's interesting how we're all kind of reacting to our parents, especially fathers. Mm-hmm, and I was very struck by the portrait of Papi, of your father in Crux, and the complex character that you drew in your memoir. And I'm actually very curious about where you got that title, Crux, because to me it seems to be, Crux means also like crucifix, like cross. And there's a moment in a passage in her memoir where her father feels like he really has to turn away from narcotics once and for all. And he finds religion and he gets a crucifix and breaks the Jesus off and holds it over a flame and then puts it on his chest, brands himself on the chest with it and scars himself. And I wonder if some of crux comes from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just this whole idea of crossings was something that I wanted to explore, not only because of the crossings that my father embodied, but also because of the contradiction that the cross, the shape of the cross represents. My father, even though he's someone who is perceived by most people as being detached from reality, he also, in that process of crossing borders constantly, crossing, always moving beyond the known, beyond the familiar, beyond the comfortable, he gave me my journalistic instincts and my journalistic curiosity. So it was this weird contradiction that I wanted to embody in the book, where he gave me both a gift and a curse and the tools, an obsession with him, but also the tools to separate from him ultimately.
How did he feel about being the subject of your journalistic eye?
So at first, he was very concerned about me wanting to write a book because he thought that he told me that that the CIA was going to come after me if I did a book truly talking about his experiences. But after years and years of conversations, he began to realize that this was something that I had to do for myself and for my own evolution, and not out of a place of bitterness or resentment, but a true place of curiosity and love. And so one of the most amazing things to come out of this book has been just that closeness that I got with my father. I don't think he'd ever really been listened to or taken seriously by anyone before me. And he's been incredibly supportive. He hasn't actually read the book. He says he's trying to work up the courage to do it, but he's been so supportive. Like, I had an uncle who read it immediately, his brother, and he called my dad up and was scandalized, and he was like, "Oh my God, did you know that your daughter portrays you as a drug addict?" And my dad was telling me this, and he was laughing about it, and he's like, "Haha, like, you know, I just told him, like, this is a memoir. This is not a novel. I am a drug addict." So it's amazing, like, what this book has done is just my dad has just, or not the book itself, but the process. It really brought us together in a way.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's really amazing.
Well, we're gonna open it up for questions in a couple minutes. So start thinking about your question. But I have one more question for Octavio, because when you write memoir, what you leave out is just as important as what you put in. So I was really curious about your process of selecting the stories that you included, and also wondering when you left things out, what were those things, and how did you go about selecting what to put in and what not to include?
I don't remember much of my childhood. I only remember the bad things. And I didn't want to put all the bad things in there because I thought that my life was more than just that. It's just that I you know, you whip someone with a belt and that it stings well into adulthood. You can just sort of you feel those, you feel that pain, and you never let it go. You never forget it, and it tends to block out everything else. It gets larger than all the cumulative events of your life when you're a kid, so I had writing these was a struggle because I had to try to remember what had happened, and I check in with my brothers and sisters sometimes, but because I was the oldest, I had a very different memory of events in our household than my brothers and sisters. Sometimes my brothers would completely deny that anything untoward had ever happened. So I had to write these memories as they came, as I remembered them. And they would come like once every 2 weeks, sometimes every 2 months, in the late part of the night, well after midnight. And I'd sit there and write it down, and write it down almost like automatic writing, like as quickly as I could in a single breath, and then read it aloud to myself, And then if I remembered something more, I would write something more on the sides or whatever. I'd embellish it. And then eventually I started cutting them back till they were really, really concise. But at some point I had to deal with some really harsh things in our family that had happened. And things that I thought had only happened in my family. Then I read your book, and then I come across your book, and I realize, oh my God, we all had the same childhood. It was all rough. But the difference was with me and my parents is that they changed. My dad especially, he was rough. He was very, very, very rough on us. But he changed. He changed when I was still a teenager and became a completely different man. And I don't know what precipitated it. I've never found out. But he's like a different person. It's like someone else replaced him. And so I thought I could write about those moments where he was not that. And this is as close as I got with Wild Kingdom. But they were worse. I had to be very careful because they're still alive. And I love them and they're sweet. And I don't want to hurt them. And I kind of wanted to write this book anyway for my mother. But that's actually not working out as well because she's in the early throes of Alzheimer's. And she's past the point of being able to read something all the way through.
My father changed too. But he changed too late. You know, he changed... And then when he was diagnosed with liver cancer, and he died a year after his diagnosis. So he had finally become the father that I had been waiting for him to be, you know, like very attentive, and he wanted us around. He even invited us to his house for Thanksgiving, and he made us turkey. It was his first time that he was making turkey. And we all got diarrhea the next day because he had never heard of a meat thermometer. But that's like my most favorite memory because my father had changed. He wanted us around. He showed his love. That turkey was his way of telling us how much he loved us. And then he died. So I didn't get to enjoy that. You're lucky your father changed when you were a teenager. You got to enjoy
that. And I feel that. I definitely feel that. But your experience must have been very different because you also wrote about your grandparents as well, and telling the story of your grandmother and your mother. Just you depict them. I mean, they are such warriors, real warriors.
They really are. I mean, through the writing of the book, I just became incredibly aware of the strength of the female figures in my family. But speaking of the changes that our fathers underwent, I mean, I touched on that, on some of the changes. But what really made me decide that I had to write this book was when my father began to call me all the time and tell me that he was going to die, that he had decided he didn't want to live anymore. And that made me really hysterical. I was a foreign correspondent at the time, and I decided I was going to quit my job, and I was going to write this book, and I was going to give my father a new vision of himself. And it was really naive and unhealthy. And luckily, I had a mentor who told me, "You cannot write from a place of wanting to save your father." Because it's not a secure foundation from which to write. Because then every sentence that you write, you're going to be writing it based on a guess as to what his response is going to be. You can never predict how someone is going to react to your writing. You have to find another reason to write this book. So that led to a transformation in me where I had to start to think of it as a selfish process. Where
saving yourself.
Exactly. It's just... trying to separate myself.
It really feels that way. It feels like you're tracking your own progress in the book, your own growth. And there are places where you start to doubt your own sanity. You wondered if maybe you are your father's daughter and the same thing that befell him will befall you. That must have been terrifying.
Yeah. And journalism really provided the tools to keep me grounded. I don't think that I could have pursued any other career and turned out the way that I am right now. It's just having those tools to constantly question, like, is this really what I believe? Because there was a time where I was like, okay, my father has this great-grandmother who was a curandera, who heard voices nobody else could hear and saw things nobody else could see. So clearly he had shamanic powers and couldn't figure out how to channel them. But through the writing of the book and keeping my feet firmly on the ground, I realized that reality was way more complicated than that. I couldn't reduce my father to a schizophrenic or a shaman or bad or good. And through the writing of the book, it was just this realization that labels are often so destructive to our own evolutions as people, because they do violence to our concept of reality.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I think we're going to open it up for questions now. Yeah, so just raise your hand and a microphone will come to you.
Question over here?
Yeah, question.
Hi. I do activism. My name is Paulina, and I'm also undocumented, so I identify with a lot of what is spoken about. And my question would be, how do you own your story, knowing that these people are still alive, knowing that, you know, they are going to read your story? And how do you find the courage to talk about such unfortunate events?
Definitely, when you write memoir, one of the things you have to deal with is the fact that you're not just writing about yourself, because we don't live in an island, you know. We're going to be writing about our families, our friends, the people that played a part in the story that we're trying to tell. And the first thing would be to remember that you are writing your story, and they happen to be part of it. But you have to be very clear, like Jean said, you have to know what you're writing, you know. So when you write your story, you're not writing it for revenge. You're not writing it, you know, to get back at someone. Like, you have to really be true to the story and honest as to why you're doing it. So if you're writing it for yourself and as a way to use your writing as an act of liberation, use your writing as a way to find meaning in your experiences and to really understand, and also to have a deeper understanding of the people that you're writing about, I'm going to say that's really where the writing really becomes so alive and honest and raw. So that's where I would start, you know, asking yourself, why do you want to write it, and then go from there.
For me, I thought of them as characters, like characters in a story, in a play, that had their own integrity. And like characters in a play, they have their own reasons for doing what they do. And the only way you can approach those characters is by applying empathy. You just have to be empathetic and not sort of judge them or mark them as evil, no matter how harsh and cruel they can be. Because we can all be very cruel. That exists in us all. And once you sort of see them in that way, then you grant them a little more room to sort of, you widen the lens a little bit, and you can see them better.
And I also think it's just so important that if you're going to examine the lives of the people that you love in this very deep and objective way, it's really important to turn that back onto yourself and make sure that you're not trying to, that you're just as honest and scrutinizing with your own actions and your own flaws, and just make sure that you're just as rigorous with your own portrait of yourself. And then I think it gives it frees you to be honest about everybody.
First off, thank you all for such powerful, meaningful stories. They're really amazing. A question for Octavio. I loved your stories, particularly the one about your dead brother. What was the seed? Can you describe the seed, the memory that evoked the story you eventually wrote? It wasn't incomplete the first time you put pen to paper.
No. I saw someone at the airport who I envied. He looked like every kind of like Mexican I wish I could have been. He just looked like a better me, a much better me. And I just projected my brother onto him. What if he had lived? What if he had gone on this, had this other life? But I had no idea that he would take sort of such a darker turn. I thought, well, I guess things have a reason for the way they turn out. And I thought it was going to be part of a longer story, you know, but it just ended. So I said, well, that's okay. I guess that in my book, the retablos are that I can allow for character studies. Mm-hmm. There's another one of Consuelo, the lady who took care of us when we were little, who came from the Montes from Mexico and took care of us and spoke only Spanish. It was like our grandmother, but did everything, cooked and cleaned for us, everything while my parents worked and disciplined us, etc. And then once everyone was eating at the table, she would retire back in her room, and she would close the door, let down her hair, her long gray hair that went all the way down. She'd undo the braid that she had, and she would pray. And one day I thought I would peek in and see what she was doing. And she was eating a little moldy apple that we had thrown earlier that day in the garbage. And she was executing her own commandment. Waste nothing of God's, is what she said. Eat your food, waste nothing of God's. And so there she was eating this little moldy apple like it was a sacred object. And I was very moved by that. And so I have very few memories of Consuelo doing anything else, but I remember that about Consuelo. So it stayed with me. So I wrote that out as a kind of character study.
Another question?
Octavio, this is for you. Knowing you from a long time ago and knowing that you are a major in playwriting, I can see it in your stories. And I'm just wondering, with this, although it is a memoir, do you see or do you feel any of those characters speaking to you that they might want more of a life in a play or a screenplay or something like that?
Well, I wrote them this way because I didn't want them to be in a play. Then they have to conform to the rules of dramaturgy and directors, and actors have to have their ideas about what the character should say. And I wanted to keep it pure, just me. Me and those people, these ghosts that live inside me. I didn't want to share them with anyone else. That's why they came out that way. I think I'd like to keep them that way. But we'll see. I mean, we'll see. You know, I'm looking at their works and I'm thinking, wow, they're filmic. They could be turned into film. They're so vivid. And not only that, we need those stories out. We need them. I think they could do it themselves. I think they're really quite good at that. You know, they could do it really well.
Another question?
When I'm thinking of the monarch butterflies that go over borders, or the reference earlier to different kinds of borders between mental health and other kinds of states of being, I'm just wondering your general thoughts, all three of you, about borders. It's a place of fear in our culture now, or it's been made into a place of fear, the border. And just any thoughts you might have. Someone once described it to me as a place of coming together rather than a place of separating. And just your thoughts on borders.
Yeah, well, I have a very personal relationship with borders because since the moment I was two, there was a border standing between me and my father and then my mother. And I feel that then when I crossed the border, we got caught two times, and then we made it across on the third time. And as we made our way to Los Angeles, I thought, I did it. I crossed the border. No more borders. And then I got here, and I realized I had come to a country that loves to put up borders, you know, real and metaphorical for immigrants. And I've had to cross many other borders since I crossed the border through Tijuana. It makes me really sad to see that we've been building more and more borders globally. You know, when the Berlin Wall fell, there were only 15 border walls. Now there's like almost 70 border walls in the world, and we keep building more. To me, I mean, I feel that we're going backwards in terms of building these walls between us instead of trying to create more bridges, you know, between us as communities, as a global society. We're moving the other way, and that's just the wrong way to go. I also feel that here in the U.S., you know, our president has been talking so much about building border walls, and they're going to start one in February in Texas, a six-mile border wall that's going to cost $145 million for 6 miles. And to me, like, it just, I feel that we're focusing on the wrong thing because in terms of decreasing illegal migration, you don't build a wall. You increase legal migration, right? I mean, that would be more common sense if we're so against illegal immigration. Also, I think we should be more compassionate and increase our asylum acceptances that we have. You know, we're just not taking in that many refugees. And we can also start thinking about how have our foreign policies and our political decisions, how have those things been creating migration? Because we have created those factors that have now forced displaced people, you know? And the caravans that are coming right now, all those people that are walking here, we had a hand in that displacement. We are responsible for those people leaving their homes. And I think that as a society, we need to start talking more about how can we reverse the damage that we have done in other countries so that people can finally be able to stay home. Because nobody wants to leave their home. Nobody wants to go through this trauma of migrating and being displaced and being homeless, emotionally homeless. And I think we need to start having a deeper conversation as a society.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, as an immigration reporter, what you just said really resonates because the wall as a physical object fails to consider the fact that so much of the illegal immigration that we see from Mexico and from Central America is a result of our own policies and our own demand for drugs. And so it fails, the wall, what it does is it fails to see the connections that exist between U.S. actions and actions south of the border. So for me, the border is like, as a symbol, it's this opportunity to advocate for curiosity. So for moving beyond the known world, the, what we know, what is the known world to us. So we believe, okay, Mexico is over there, the United States is over here, their problems are their problems, our problems. But when you really push beyond that very reductionistic and incorrect thinking, you begin to see reality for what it really is.
We've had a wall in El Paso for like decades. They built it between Juarez and El Paso, almost the entire length between the two countries, and added a border freeway along there to boot, so make it even harder for people to come across. And it hasn't stopped anything. They get around it, they get over it, they get under it.
All the tunnels in San Diego.
There's tunnels everywhere. It has done, accomplished nothing, but created animus between these two communities.
And deaths.
And deaths. Oh yeah, and it's unfortunate. My father came over as an undocumented worker. He lived when he married my mom. They lived with my grandmother in El Paso, but he worked in Juarez. He went to work in Juarez daily, until finally, one of the people at the checkpoint, one of the men there, said, "Hey, didn't you go through here earlier?" He went, "Yeah." "This morning?" "Yeah." "Did you come here yesterday and the day before and do that?" And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, why?" "That's why I work here." "Well, why'd you go there?" "Well, I live there." "Well, you can't do that." He said, "You have to decide here and now where you live and where you're going to work, because you can't have it both ways." And my dad said, "Well, my family's here." He says, "Well." So he decided, "Well, I'm going to be here." And he stayed there, and he became an American. But before, it was easy. You could just sometimes, they used to have a streetcar. You used to just ride it over and go shopping in Juarez, ride the streetcar back and get off. And people would do that the other way around too. They would work in El Paso and then go home in Juarez, and it just was so much more fluid. And the reason it was fluid is because families lived on both sides. The river didn't mean anything. And communities, El Paso and Juarez were like one large city. El Paso is really one of the most isolated cities in the country. The nearest largest city, I think, is Dallas. Dallas, Texas, that's like 800 miles away. Or Santa Fe, which is also pretty far up north. And yet, right across that river is Juarez, Ciudad Juarez. And so I always thought of them as, I always thought of those communities as one larger community.
Yeah, so. And I think it's important as we talk about borders that we talk about the human cost, but also the cost to our flora and the fauna that's been impacted by the erection of these border walls, and also the way it's impacted the land itself, in that there's been more flooding now in these border towns because of the wall, and the way that it's been really impacting how water flows, and even like the wind flows, and the animals not being able to go back and forth now in their natural habitat. So we need to really talk about the cost of these border walls beyond the money and beyond human lives and what it's really doing to the environment.
There are ecological consequences.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about border security, I think one thing that we've failed to realize, I don't know if it's because of bad reporting or what, but most of the dangerous contraband coming through our border is coming through the ports of entry, not through the areas where there isn't a wall. It's coming through the areas where there is a wall. So it really, like, the best option is to increase technology to detect that kind of dangerous contraband that leads, and also the southbound
smuggling
of guns.
Or to end the drug epidemic in this country, which is driving the supply and demand, right?
Yeah.
So thank you so much, everyone, for being here. We're going to have to wrap it up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
We're going to have a book signing out there, but I appreciate the intense listening that you gave us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.